Steve Lamb, alcoholic. It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. Thanks, Tom, for inviting me to share. It's always an honor and a privilege to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is interesting. Apparently, this is quite the global group of people, apparently from everywhere. I see Pennsylvania, New York, and Florida, and a bunch of people from Vegas, and even let a couple in from California. So you've got some pretty bad judgment, but I won't get into that. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's SAG. It's in Southern California, and my sobriety date is July 27th, 1996. I've been sober 24 years and some change, and I've been consecutively sober since then. And if you're new and you've been struggling, I'm sure you're really thrilled for me. It's just my story. It's not really that impressive. Frankly, I got in here when I was 37, almost 38, and I was just beaten into a state of reasonableness. Sometimes that beating takes some of us a little bit longer than others, particularly younger people for some reason. But when I came in, I was just, I was gassed. And I want to tell you that I'm not an authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't appointed. I wasn't anointed. I'm just the guy that Tom was able to wrangle up at a 4 p.m. my time, 7 p.m. East Coast time, and I'm here to share my experience. My experience as Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential, and you're here to have your experience, not mine and not your sponsors. And I got that through the steps, but it didn't start out that way. I got popped for a DUI. I used to drive drunk all the time, but I finally got caught, and I got sentenced to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sentenced to go to 6 meetings in 6 months, which I thought was excessive, and I didn't want to go. And so I held out a while. I went about, almost 5 months before I started going to any meetings. And I've been sober since my first meeting, but that wasn't the plan. That wasn't by design. I remember the first thing that happened to me was I identified. You were telling my story. Now, the facts and the circumstances were different, but it was essentially my story, and I couldn't evade it. And I knew I got to stop drinking. I mean, I'm the kind of alcoholic that my wife sends me out to get milk, and I come back 3 days later. Now, I know going to get milk is a simple task. It's really not that complicated. There's maybe 3 or 4 subparts to it. You got to leave the house. You got to go to the store. You got to buy the milk, and you got to come home with the milk. And I'm pretty good at the first 2 or 3 steps. The whole coming home with the milk part, not so much. What happens is I run into a guy like Tom, and Tom says something to me something rather benign. He says, "Do you want to have a beer?" Well, of course I want to have a beer. I mean, what's the harm in having a beer? A beer is like a basic food group, right? But I'm alcoholic, so as soon as I have that beer, I want another, because it doesn't quench my thirst. It makes me thirstier. It scratches that itch. It triggers that allergic reaction. But because I'm alcoholic and I don't understand the concept of enough, the beer's not fast enough. It's not getting me there. So I need a little accelerant. And what I like is tequila. So I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila. Drinking beer, shooting tequila. 3 days later, I come to, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, but I'm not entirely inconsiderate. So I go to the store and I get the milk, and I come home with the milk, and I look at my wife. I'm like, "Hey, baby, I got the milk." She is not impressed. In fact, she's rather annoyed. She's pissed off. I don't understand the problem. It seems like I just left. She's overreacting. I don't understand the problem. I used to think that I was engaged in time travel. Since I've been sober, I realize that's blacking out. It's really a popular pastime of ours, and we're really good at it. But people who aren't alcoholic are not really impressed with that skill set. So I got it. I got to stop drinking. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stop drinking. And there were people at the meetings that I was going to that were saying things to me like, "Don't drink and go to meetings. Meetings, meetings, meetings. Meeting makers make it. 90 meetings in 90 days," all of which is good practical advice. And it's what I believe is activity, but it's not really action in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I don't know that. And there are other people that are talking about the 12 steps. They're talking about the program, which is the 12 steps. They're talking about the big book, which is where you find them. They're talking about finding a God, or if you prefer the term, a higher power. And they're talking about a sponsor. But I'm not drinking. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to overreact here. The last thing I want to do is get over sober. And other people are telling me don't leave before the miracle. So I'm just squatting and holding and waiting for the miracle. And the miracle is not happening. You guys are talking about being restored to sanity, and I feel like I'm going nuts. I'm just out of my mind. I went about 100 days stark raving sober. And then I went on a business trip. I'm a trial lawyer by trade. I was getting ready to do a trial, and I needed to do some depositions back east. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I get there at the beginning of the week. I'm supposed to be there all week, but I get done around midweek. I get done a little early. I go back to my hotel room. And in my hotel room, I've got an honor bar. Now, I'm a newcomer. I don't have any honor, but they've given me this little mini fridge. I've got the key to it, and it doesn't have everything I want and need in it, but it's a really good start. I mean, 2 by 2 by 2, there's some bourbon, there's gin, there's vodka, there's no tequila, which was annoying, but there's beer, domestics, imports. There's a lot of good stuff in there, and I want to drink, but I know I can't drink. I know I can't drink successfully. So what I do is I'm opening and shutting the honor bar. I'm having a conversation with the honor bar. And if any of you have seen the movie Flight with Denzel Washington, you know those honor bars, they talk to you. It's talking to me. I'm talking to it. We're having a conversation. I open it. I shut it. I arrange the domestics, the imports. I do a little inventory just in case. And I start getting really nervous because I'm afraid, you know, I'm going to drink. So I decide to distract myself. Now, people have been telling me if you go to a foreign city, you know, call AA, call Intergroup, call their central office, you know, join the fellowship. I don't do that. I try to distract myself. I turn on the television. I flip back and forth between religious television and porno, religious television and porno. And I'm getting a little confused as to who's doing what on what station. But that's a personal problem. It's an outside issue. I'm not going to get into that. The bottom line is I don't drink. You can call it the dumb luck of the alcoholic. Norm Alpe used to refer to it as seconds and inches. I believe it's the grace of God, but I would have never used that phrase then. I love the big book. I love the 12 and 12. But when I was new and I finally got a sponsor, one of the things that my sponsor, Michael, had me do is listen to a series of talks by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. He gave those talks in 1975 down in Palo Mesa, which is just down the road from me here. I'm just outside of L.A., and this is kind of down towards San Diego. And he was doing a retreat in 1975, and before he passed away, right before he passed away, one of his sponsees had these transcribed, and they put it in a book called A New Pair of Glasses. It's not conference-approved literature. It's just one man's story about his journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that book really kind of changed my life. I identified a lot with it, and one of the things that's in that book, there's one drawing in the book. There's only one drawing in the whole book. It's a very simple drawing. What Chuck does is he draws a circle and he puts all the people, plants, and animals inside the circle of life. And then he puts life, good, God, whatever your concept of higher power is, inside the circle of life. And then Chuck draws a stick man outside the circle, separate and apart. And that's Chuck and that's me. And I'm not judging, but I'm assuming that that's you, at least from your perception, since you're listening to me on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening, wherever you are. What separates me and Chuck and you from the circle of life is a thin line that Chuck identifies as ego, or conscious separation from God. In the 11th step, we're striving for conscious contact, but I'm a newcomer and I've got conscious separation. The 12 and 12 refers to it as anxious apartness. My experience is that is the grand illusion, the prime delusion of every alcoholic. Every alcoholic feels that separation, that apartness. It's not real. The truth is, it's physically and spiritually impossible for there to be the entire universe within the circle of life and then Lamb outside it. That's impossible. I'm in the circle. You're in the circle. We're all in the circle. But I'm new and I'm going out of my mind and I haven't done the steps. So I haven't come to that realization yet. And I certainly am not capable of demonstrating it. But I don't drink. I go downstairs, I get in a car, I go out to the airport, I fly home, I get up the next morning, and I've got a newcomer plan. And if you're new and I'm sure you've got a plan. And if you're like me, you're thinking that plan is brilliant. Because to us, it seems brilliant. The book tells us on page 23 that the main problem, therefore, we think is centers in the mind, not the body. But when we're new, we think we're brilliant. Now, if you have a newcomer plan, my suggestion is that you tell it to somebody who's been around a while, preferably a sponsor. And when they get done laughing, hopefully you can see the ridiculousness of your plan. But my plan was this. I was in the military for 13 and a half years. I went through airborne school and ranger school. I went through special forces selection and assessment. I wound up going to law school. When I got out of the Army, I had a TSSCI clearance, and I'd acquired some things. I had a kit bag. We call it a go bag, that I had some weapons, some demolition, and some passports in. And I need these passports because my newcomer plan is I'm going to take these passports, and they've got my photograph and my name on them, but they're from different countries, and I'm leaving. I'm flying out of the United States on my passport, my blue passport. It's a citizen has one of those. And then I'm going to use these other passports that I've acquired from different countries, and I'm going to flip names and I'm going to flip identities. So they have different names on them. I'm going to do this for a couple weeks. I'm going to come back after a few weeks, and Steve Lamb will cease to exist. That's my newcomer plan. And then I'm going to head down to Costa Rica because I've got some former Army associates of mine that are doing some marketing and distribution down there. And it's a career move. And I don't tell the wife, I don't tell the daughter because, you know, I mean, it doesn't really have anything to do with them in my mind. And I lay all this stuff out on the floor, and the 13 passports that I had that I should have turned in 1993 when I got out of the Army, they're all current. They haven't expired, but my blue tourist passport, my legitimate one, has expired. So I'm crushed. I can't execute this seemingly brilliant plan. And here's the pathetic thing. I'm relatively well educated. You know, I graduated from college. The Army sent me to law school at the University of Southern California. I went and got an LLM at the JAG school right next to the University of Virginia. I'm licensed to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States of America. But on that fall morning of 1996, I did not have the cranial capacity. My synapses weren't clicking enough to realize this is pre-9/11. I could have flown to British Columbia on my driver's license. You didn't need a passport back then. I was just so messed up in my head. My New York friends sometimes refer to it as MOCUS, mind out of focus. And that's what I had. And they, you know, and I went to a meeting that morning. I didn't know what to do. And I made the mistake of telling somebody what I was thinking and that I thought maybe I should get a sponsor. And he grabbed me and he took me outside and he introduced me to a guy I'd never met before. He says, Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsor, sponsee, go with God. And he walked away laughing. And I didn't think it was funny. It wasn't even slightly amusing. I don't even know this guy. I've never met him. But Michael's all excited because he's just been delivered a new fish. And, you know, so he's reaching in his pocket. He's all excited. He writes down his phone number and his name. And he tells me to be at his house Monday night at 6:30 and to read in the big book from the very beginning through the doctor's opinion. Highlight what I agree with, what I don't agree with, what I identify with. If I've got questions, go ahead, write in the book. It's your book. And then he asked me to read the first chapter, step one, and the 12 and 12. And I got to tell you, for a long time, I thought that the guy that delivered me to Michael, who was my grand sponsor for a while until he passed away, Jim, I thought he was trying to help me. That's not what was going on. I now realize that Michael had about 5 years. He was having a rough spell. Jim saw me, grabbed me, took me out, gave me to Michael and said, here, play with this. This will keep you distracted for a while because that's what sponsees are. We're a divine distraction. We help each other get out of self. And in that process, we get into whatever we believe is God or a higher power. So I do my homework. I get up there and I show up at 6:30 on Monday night. I've read things. I've highlighted things. And Michael asks me a little bit about myself. And I tell him, you know, and I tell him my stupid newcomer plan. He tells me a little bit about himself. And then he says, okay, open the book and start reading. I said, no, I did the homework. I did what you asked me to do. I'm ready to discuss it. He goes, no. Open the book. We're going to start reading. I said, no, really, honestly, I read it. I'm ready to talk about it. He goes, no, that's not how we're going to do it. You're going to read a paragraph or two. I'm going to read a paragraph or two. We're going to discuss it. We're going to go through the whole book that way. And my first thought was, oh, this is pathetic. Obviously, he's probably stupid. Maybe he can't even read. But like I said, I've been beaten into a state of reasonableness. I got nothing. I don't want to embarrass him or me. I got nowhere to go. So I start reading with him. Now, I found out later that he's got a master's degree in nuclear engineering, and he was the chief technology officer of one of the largest gaming companies in the world. He retired about 2 years ago, and he's younger than me. But I thought he was an idiot for a long time, my sponsor. So we go through and we read the book. And when we got to a prayer, we said the prayer. And when we got to a step, we worked the step. And it worked. And I was convinced it wouldn't work. And if you're new and you've been in the rooms and you've seen, you know, the banners that have the 12 steps, the shades that have the 12 steps, or you've looked at page 59 and 60 and you've looked at the 12 steps. If you're like me, you don't look at that and go, oh, God, thank God. You know, Mickey, I've been waiting my whole life for this. Will you please take me through these 12 golden steps so that I can find and develop a God of my understanding so that I can live and move and have my being in the world without drinking alcohol or doing any of the party substances that some of us like? And will you do that for me? No, we don't do that. We look at it and we're like, are you kidding me? That's it? That is there like a door number two? And we're not stupid. I mean, we look at there four and five. That's like confession. I'm a trial lawyer. That's evidence. That's not good. And if that's not bad enough, then you got 8 and 9. Amends. No, I'm not stupid. I know it's their money. But, you know, some of them, they don't even know I've got it. And how is me giving them back their money going to help me stay sober? It makes no sense. And if you're new, you're absolutely right. It's actually ridiculous. It makes no sense because it's spiritual. And it only works after you work in it. And it will never make any sense until you do it. But once you do it and you look back and reflect on what's happened, then it makes sense. The bizarre thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is the thinking is the real problem. Obviously, the not drinking is a big part. Don't get me wrong. We'd be a lot bigger organization if it wasn't for the not drinking part. You know, the not drinking part can be a moose. Okay, but once you stop drinking, then this starts working. And you've got to deal with that. But we don't tell you to change your thinking. What we do is we ask you to take certain steps that you probably don't believe in, that you probably disagree with, that you probably think are ridiculous. And by taking these actions, somehow that changes our perception, that changes our thinking. That's what we call the psychic change, the spiritual awakening, the reorganization of thought that allows us to live and move and have our being in the world without drinking alcohol or doing party favors. And it works. And there's a lot of people that come into AA and they'll be up at a podium and they'll say AA is for the people that really want it. And then somebody else will come in and say, no, it's for people that really need it. Both of those things are probably true. But I got to tell you, my experience is for people that do it, if you do the work will do you. I had a really crappy attitude when I got here. And now I love Alcoholics Anonymous and I see things differently because I've had a different experience through working the steps. And for some of the people that are new, I want to tell you some of my experience with some of the steps, you know, like, you know, I didn't really have a problem with the first step. You know, I know I'm powerless over alcohol. I told you about the whole thing with the milk and my life's unmanageable, obviously, because I've asked this guy to sponsor me. The second step, you know, come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I had some difficulty with that. You know, it wasn't that I didn't believe in God, but people were telling me, you know, find God or die. And I'm like, find God. I'm kind of hoping he doesn't find me. And I've read ahead. I know there's an 8 and a 9. This is not going to go well. And we had a lot of discussion about my concept of God. And we had a lot of discussion about old ideas. And my experience is that one of the oldest ideas a lot of us have is this idea of God. You know, and if we can just park that on a bench for a while. You know, Michael told me, he said, look, if you've got a spiritual practice or a religious belief, we have no argument with that. In fact, we tell you that be quick to see where religious people are right. There are many good books, and you'll go further, go deeper. You know, but if you've got a problem with alcoholism, we just suggest that you lay the steps over whatever your other spiritual practices are. And if you don't have a spiritual practice or you've got a problem with a God thing, then don't worry about it. The big book uses the word God over 100 times, but it also uses higher power, creative intelligence, universal mind. At one point in time on page 13, Bill refers to God as my newfound friend with a capital F. Michael says to me, don't you want a friend? And I'm like, yeah, you're trying to trick me. I know what's going on here. I know what we're talking about, right? But he's like, look, do you think it's possible that you can be restored to sanity? Yeah, anything's possible. He said, well, that's enough. But now we're right up against the third step. I got to, you know, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to this thing that I, you know, I don't believe in really because I haven't experienced it yet. And he said, well, why don't you look at that word as a placeholder for an experience you haven't had yet? He asked me if I like music. I said, yeah, I like music. Do you know anybody that doesn't like music? No, everybody likes music. What type of music do you like? Well, I like blues and rock. Well, if you were talking to somebody like country or punk or classical music, would you insist that they have to listen to your music? I said, no, that makes no sense. We like the music that we like. Michael's like, precisely. That's exactly like the concept of a higher power or God in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not telling you what it is. We're suggesting that if you seek it, you'll find it. And all we want you to do is get in tune with the rhythm and harmony that makes sense to you. You can name it whatever you'd like. That started, all right, I'm kind of buying it, but then I'm still having a problem. So he takes me to page 37 in the 12 and 12. Page 37 in the 12 and 12 has something called the acid test. And essentially what it asks is, how is what you're doing working for you? I'm like, not very good, Michael. I'm sitting here talking to you. He goes, well, then why don't you try it our way? And by the way, on page 88 in the 12 and 12, when you get into the 10th step, there's the same test. So after you do 3 through 9, it asks you the same question. And in every instance, personally and with everybody that I've ever worked with, the answer is it's always going better. Because AA, if anything, is practical. If it didn't work, we wouldn't do it. It does. So I go through this process. I do this third step. I'm told I can write my own prayer. I go through that process. And I remember asking Michael, well, how will I know if I've done a good third step? He says, well, you're going to do it the whole life. But a good general indication is if you get into your fourth step. So now I get into this fourth step. He takes me to page 65. He gives me the instructions. And I write out a fourth step. And even though we share in a general way to show you how simple and basic this process can be. And by the way, however your sponsor is having you do it, this is the way you should do it. There's a lot of different ways to do inventory. The only bad way to do inventory is not do inventory. But he wanted me to be very simple. He said, looking at the columns, you only need 2 or 3 words, you know. And so I got the first column. I'm resentful at. 2 words, my father. Second column, the cause. 2 words, deserted me. Now, like the book says, Michael's prepared for a long talk. He asked me some questions. I explained to him it's the early 60s. I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada. My father was in the Air Force. He left. He went to Vietnam. And he stayed there for a long time. Many, many, many years. He did a couple tours in the Air Force. He joined an outfit called Air America. He met a Thai woman, Lian Thong, married her. I have a half-sister, Peck. I'd never met Peck and I'd never met Lian Thong. And I'd hardly spoken to my father in over 3 decades. He deserted me. The third column, what did it affect? What is the condition, the underlying, everything? Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. I mean, other than that, it's going pretty good. But it's like my old grand sponsor, Scott Redman, used to say, it's like a 5-bagger. It's a big deal. My life is shot through it. My sponsor can see this, but I can't. I'm just talking about my father, whom I detest. Now I got to look at my character defects, sometimes referred to as the fourth column, page 67, mistake, fault, or blame. I write down anger. I was really angry as a little kid. I'm still pretty pissed off. Fear. I have a lot of fear. What does the fear look like? I love my father. And he deserted me. And basically, I gave him a certain amount of power. He abused it. I'll never let that happen again. There has to be a wall of insulation between me and you and you and me. And then like it says on 66 and 67, sometimes referred to as a prayer to the sick man, I am not willing to look at my father as a child of God who could be spiritually sick like me. I'm not willing to ask God for patience and tolerance in relation to my father. I'm not willing to forgive my father. And I read this to Michael. I'm getting ready to go on to the next person. And Michael stops me. He goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. I got some questions. I'm like, all right, what are they? Well, if I understand you right, you're resentful at your dad, right? Yeah. He deserted you when you were a young boy. And it's a big deal. You know, it's affected everything. And you've got some residual anger, a lot of fear, and you don't want to forgive your father. I'm like, yeah, Michael, and I've read ahead. I know there's an 8 and a 9. It's not going to happen, ever. He kind of chuckled. He said, look, we're just doing the 5th step here tonight. But I do have one more question. I'm like, okay, what is it? He goes, well, you know, when you came to me, you know, we talked that first time, that first night, you told me about that newcomer plan that you had. It involved some passports and going to Costa Rica. You got a wife, you got a daughter. You never said to me that you were planning on deserting them, but is there really a functional difference between what you were planning on doing and in what your father actually did? My first thought was, this is not going the way I thought it was going to go at all. Okay, and I experienced something that our literature refers to as ego deflation at depth. It just felt like the air got sucked out of me. I mean, here I am, you know, talking about what my father is, and he's pointed out to me that I've become my father. Not a happy day. This is actually a spiritual experience. I didn't realize it at the time. A lot of times when we talk about these, we talk about like Bill's white light experience or the burning bush or you hear God and God says, this is my daughter in whom I'm well pleased or my son in whom I'm well pleased. I'm not putting down any of that, but those are pretty rare. But this experience is not that rare for alcoholics. It's more of what, not a white light experience. It's what my sponsor sometimes is referred to as a black light experience. And what he means by that is if any of you have ever seen any of the crime movies like CSI, what happens is when the crime tech gets to the scene, he or she takes a substance called luminol and sprays it all over the room. They turn out the lights and they turn on the black light, and the evidence of the crime appears in phosphorescence all over the wall, usually in form of a blood spatter. That's what happened to me. The evidence of who I was, that I'd become my father, was exposed to me, and I'm not happy about this. I go through the rest of the inventory. I get home, like it says, I'm quiet. I review what I've done. I flip the page to 76. You know, I got to do 6 and 7. 6 is a lot about willingness, and 7 is a lot about humility. I've got very little of either, but I'm pretty scared. I'm trying to move through this. Those two steps mean a lot more to me now, but at the time, I really had kind of a superficial gloss over them because I got to get to 8. And by the way, you get to the 8th step on page 76. And that damn book says that we have a list of people we're supposed to make amends to. We made it when we did inventory. And I'm thinking, well, crap, if I'd have known that, I would have never put my father on the list. So I took him off the list because I'm not making amends to my father. So I write out this list, and Michael has me write proposed amends. And this takes me, a week or so. And I show up at his house, and he says, let me see the list. I hand him the list. He looks at the list. He says, your father's not on the list. I'm like, you're damn right he's not on the list. I told you he wasn't going to be on the list. He goes, do you think you're any better than your father? And I'm like, no, Michael, you know, you pointed that out. I got it. He goes, you know, a lot of times at the end of the meeting, we say this thing called the Lord's Prayer. What do you think of that? I don't have a problem with the Lord's Prayer. He goes, well, you know, there's a clause in there. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. What do you think that means? Like, I think it's a damn trick question. I'm not stupid. It's a spiritual truth. It's a maxim. It's an axiom. I got it. I'm only forgiven to the extent that I forgive. You know, he takes me to page 99 in the 12 and 12, the 11th step prayer. It's through forgiving that we are forgiven. You know, what do you think of that? Yeah, it makes sense. I got it. Are you willing to do it? Hell no. No way. He goes, well, look, you know, 6 and 8 are a lot about willingness. Are you willing to pray for the willingness to make amends to your father? Sure, I'll do it. Goes, okay, you pray, I'll pray. In the meantime, start making amends. So I go out, I start paying back the money. I'm acting better. I change my behavior. I make amends to my wife. I am back in the big bed. I don't quite have the crossover privileges that I think I deserve, but things are going better. I'm getting into this 10, 11, and step 10, 11, and 12 process. I'm doing a regular inventory. I'm trying to make amends promptly. I'm praying. I'm meditating. I'm trying to get into conscious contact with this thing that I don't really have an understanding of, and I don't know that I'll ever fully have an understanding of. I'm just more interested in having the experience. And I'm trying to practice the principles in all my affairs in step 12, and apparently I'm carrying the message because guys are coming to me, and I'm sponsoring them, and I'm taking them through the steps, and they're getting sober, and they're taking guys through the steps. This goes on for several years. Everything's great. But I am not making amends to my father. And then I talked to my sponsor relatively frequently, and I was having a conversation with him, one of these throwaway conversations. I'm just telling him that I'm going up to Anchorage, Alaska, because I have to do some depositions to get ready for a trial. The trial's actually in Kansas. And Michael gets all excited. He goes, man, that is great. You'll make amends to your father. And I had forgotten that I told Michael that my father at the time was living in Wasilla, Alaska, which is 30 miles outside of Anchorage. So now my sponsor is connecting two clearly unrelated dots, and I am waving him off. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. No, I am just going to go do depositions. This has nothing to do with make amends. He goes, no, no, no. He goes, you've been praying, right? I go, yeah. Well, you're praying, I'm praying. God's talking. Can't you hear him? I'm like, no, I'm not getting a memo. No, not at all. He goes, well, Look, I want you to get quiet. You pray and meditate every morning. Get quiet. Have a conversation with your higher power. See what happens. 3 or 4 days into it, I come to this kind of realization, I should do this. You know, I've been talking this game with all these guys I sponsor. I probably ought to do the crap I'm talking about, right? You know, so I'm like, oh, man. So I go to Michael. I said, all right, I'll do it. What do I do? He just laughed at me. He goes, I don't know. I'm not going up there. Talk to God. I'm like, man, you are killing me. I used to call him the cosmic cupcake, the mystic muffin. It didn't matter what the question was. The solution was always God. I thought he was just really shallow. And I now realize that it doesn't matter what the problem is. The solution is always to turn to God. Always. But it took me a long time to realize that. And even though I realize it, I still don't always do it. Some days are better than others. So I call my father. He says he'll see me. I fly up to Anchorage. I go through the airport. I go through the terminal. I see my father. He's older than I remembered him to be. He's shorter than I remembered. And he's kind of shuffling towards me. He's uncomfortable. I, on the other hand, am striding towards him with purpose because I have made a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what the hell I'm going to do, but, you know, I'm going to go see my father. And when I got up to him, I did one of the things that I really, when I got here, I miss it now because of COVID. But when I was first here, all the hugging and hand-holding and stuff, I didn't like that, you know. And I don't know what they do in your home groups, but where I got sober in Southern California, if you're a male, it's never like the recovered supermodel female that wants to hug you. It's always the biker with a 3-day growth who's like, oh man, I love you. And you're like, oh dude, you know, back off, right? You know, I'm not drinking. You know, it's okay, right? So I didn't like any of that. But when I got out to my father without thinking, I just reached in and I grabbed him and I hugged him. And he buried his head in my shoulder and he cried and I cried. And forgiveness occurred. And all I had to do was show up and get out of the way. Now we had some subsequent conversations, but you know, a father was restored to a son and a son to a father through Alcoholics Anonymous. And last Tuesday, he died. And before he died, we had a lot of conversations. And about 10 days before he passed away, I couldn't go see him because, you know, when you're in the hospital, because he didn't have COVID, but because of the COVID restrictions, nobody could go see him. My stepmom couldn't even go see him. And I'm talking to him, doing a FaceTime, which he was terrible at because he was 88 years old. He would take the phone and stick it right into his nose. I'm like, I'm talking into his nose hairs. But we talked for a while. And my father made a beautiful, his form of an amends to me. Now, I will tell you, if it would have been a guy that I sponsor, if it would have been mine, it was lame. It wasn't very good. But because he did it, it was beautiful. And I told him that I loved him, and he told me that he loved me, and we both meant it. You know, and he was able to get out of the hospital for a day before he passed away so he could be at home, which was good. You know, but we're clean. We're clean. And through that process, I learned about forgiveness. You know, we talk a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about acceptance, but that only gets you about halfway. The only antidote for real good resentment is forgiveness. And that doesn't mean ongoing participation, but it means forgiveness. And it, you know, if it's a simple transgression, I can deal with that. But if it's something like my father, I need divine intervention. You know, I need help. I need the sponsor and I need God, or it ain't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And how do I know this works? I know this works because, about 4.5 years ago, I got shot. Now, I've been shot before, but I'm sober, and I got shot. This is before my 20th AA birthday. I'm up in a little town called Badger, California, which is right next to Sequoia National Park. It's a beautiful area. It was a Saturday morning. We'd had breakfast. I went back to my cabin. I'm sitting on my bunk, you know, minding my own business, and the gentleman upstairs from me decided that this would be a good opportunity to clear his Glock 9mm weapon, which is ordinarily not a problem. But what happened was when he pulled the slide back, he didn't release the magazine. So he pulled the slide back and then he let the slide go. And instead of removing a round, he actually jacked a round into the chamber. He's upstairs from me, points it at the floor, pulls the trigger to clear the weapon, discharges a round. It goes through the floor that he's on, which is the ceiling above me, and it enters right above my heart. And it passes and it lodged itself. I didn't know this at the time, but it lodged in my sternum. Now I'll tell you, this will this will get your attention. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk a lot about serenity. But I have to confess to you that the first word out of my mouth, I kind of yelped a shortened version of fire truck. Okay. And I checked for an exit wound. I put my finger in the wound. It sounds a little strange, but I'm, you know, because I knew I'd been shot. And the guy from upstairs comes running downstairs. He goes, "What happened?" I'm like, "You shot me. That's what happened." And then this guy starts absolutely freaking out. He's just shot a guy, shot him in the chest. He's probably thinking he might die. This is probably some type of criminal offense. This is not good. This is not good. Then a really weird thing happens. I started trying to calm him down. Now, I'll tell you, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, because if this had happened, you know, 21 years earlier, I don't know what your idea of a justified resentment is, but getting shot, that ought to qualify. I would have been 10 different shades of pissed off because of AA in this process. I'm trying to calm this guy down. But, you know, we got to go to the hospital. He drives me down to the hospital, which is in Visalia. We go into the emergency room, and I got this bloody towel on my chest, and the nurse says to me, "Can we help you?" I'm thinking it's pretty obvious, but I said, "Yeah, I've been shot." And when you tell him you've been shot, you go right to the head of the line. There's 18, 19 people in the emergency room. They don't care. They get the gurney out. There's 12, 13, 14 people working on me. They do an overhead x-ray. They hook me up to an EKG. There's a cardiothoracic surgeon. He sees up above me the x-ray. This round is lodged in my sternum. It's gone within millimeters of my heart. And after about 10 or 15 minutes, he's like, "This is just bizarre. I don't know how this missed your heart, missed every major artery. It looks like it's immobilized. It's not moving. But I got to tell you, when we did the EKG, you had this thing called an atrial flutter, which is like atrial fibrillation. Your heart is just spasming," which is not that surprising because a bullet just went within millimeters of it, right? He says, "Look, this is the type of thing. We're going to observe you for a couple of days, but then we're going to release you. But you're going to have to see your cardiologist and get this checked out because, you know, if you don't, you could have a stroke and die." Okay, no problem. So I get released and I go back down. And I see my cardiologist, and he tells me, "Look, there's this procedure that we have. It's called a cardioversion, and it works most of the time. What we do is, you know, you've seen in the movies how they'll take those paddles and paddle a guy. Well, that is barbaric. We would never do that to you. What we're going to do with you is we're going to tape these pads to your chest that are hooked to electrodes. And what we're going to do is we're going to hit you with a jolt of electricity. That will stop your heart. Well, wait. 5 to 7 seconds. We'll hit you with another jolt of electricity. That'll restart your heart, and hopefully it'll be in sync." I'm like, "You know, God, Doc, I'm not that quick on the uptake, but that sounds like you're going to kill me." He's like, "Oh, no, no, no. We don't like to look at it that way. It's a standard procedure. I've done it hundreds of times, and you'll be in the hospital. It's a controlled environment. And by the way, before the procedure occurs, there will be an anesthesiologist, and the anesthesiologist will give you something that'll make you comfortable." So I'm an alcoholic. This is like a hall pass. I'm thinking, all right, man, you know, it's not that I haven't been comfortable in 20 years, but I've been that kind of comfortable, right? And my sponsor will be cool with this. I'm like, "All right, Doc, sign me up. Let's do this thing," right? So 3-4 weeks later, I'm in the hospital. I got the gown on. I got the pads taped to me. I got an IV in me. Dr. Carlson's here. The anesthesiologist walks in. He's got a syringe of comfortable. Because I'm alcoholic, I am watching him all the way across the room because I am paying attention to this guy, right? He gets up in front of me, he leans over, and the next thing I know, Dr. Carlson's leaning over to me. He's like, "How you doing?" I'm like, "I'm good, Doc, I'm good. How do you feel?" "I feel fine. I'm ready. Let's do it." He goes, "No, no, no. The procedure's over. We already did it." I start arguing with my cardiologist. I'm like, "That ain't right. You told me this guy was going to make me comfortable. I didn't get comfortable. This didn't happen." Only an alcoholic would argue with his cardiologist about anesthesia. And that's because, you know, Scotty used to say that only alcoholics get excited about general anesthesia. Because in the old days, what they'd do is they'd give you this general anesthesia for you youngsters, and they would tell you to count back from 100. And you'd go 100, 99, 98. We love 99 and 98. But nowadays, they have really bad dope from our perspective. From their perspective, it's probably really good. They gave me the same stuff that they gave Michael Jackson. They just gave me the correct stuff, the correct dose. And the problem with this stuff is you're here, and then you're here. There's no there. It's very disappointing. But that's not really the point of the story. Is more about A, forgiveness, and B, you know, if you're new, eventually you'll get into the 12 and 12, and hopefully in chapter 10 you'll notice that it talks about various forms of inventory, and it talks about how a lot of AAs like to take an occasional retreat away from the clamors of the world. We either get with a spiritual advisor, sometimes it's a religious person, sometimes it's an AA that's got some experience, and we do some step work, or you know, sometimes it's just we're just getting away from the world, quiet, reflect. It's a safe, serene environment, these AA retreats. I got shot on an AA retreat. I was leading the retreat. I'd given a talk the night before on unity, which I thought was rather compelling, but I'm not sure that guy was paying attention. And that evening, I was scheduled to give a talk on acceptance and forgiveness. No, I'm not kidding you. But here's the best part. The guy that shot me, I sponsor him. I sponsored him then, and I sponsor him now. And that's only because Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I know he didn't do it on purpose. The reality is what I've learned in AA is that my friend Bill likes to say that we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and we take off the clown suit. We do. We absolutely do. But we don't throw it away. We hang it up. We press it. We put it in a box to take it out every once in a while just to amuse everybody. I don't know what it is about us, but that's what we do. And if we don't fall into that state of grace where we accept our human condition, if we don't realize that drifting into morbid reflection is just a way of self-obsession, then being sober is not very fun. But if we're able to do that and have a sense of humor and look around, because actually, if you're new, this is probably not very entertaining for you. I can assure you, after some time, we are wildly entertaining. We really are. I mean, if you like reality TV, just buckle up and watch us go. I mean, we are nuts. You will hear this. You know, I remember calling my sponsor one time and telling him something. I started talking to him. He says, wait, hold on. I'm like, what's up? He goes, well, I got to pull over. Why? He goes, because I'm cracking up and I don't want to wreck the car. I mean, this is what we do. This is what we do. We're just remarkably entertaining. And if you're new, I got to tell you, I like to think of Alcoholics Anonymous as God's amusement park. Bear with me for a second. You're in the park. We're all in the park. Now there's an admission price to the park. You've paid it. It's incredibly steep. Now nobody asked you if you wanted to pay the admission price into the park. You've got alcoholism. It reached up into your soul and it took it. But you're in the park. You've paid the admission price. You can come or go. There's things to do in the park. You look around. There's meetings in the park. There's these 12 things we call rides. We call steps. They're in the park. You don't have to do any of that stuff. And you can leave the park. But God's amusement park is kind of like those parking structures that don't allow in and out privileges. Meaning if you leave, you have to pay another price of admission. And you may not be able to do it. You know, the rooms have a lot of empty chairs of people that couldn't pay that second or third or fourth admission price. But you're in the park, you know. You can hang out. You can go. But you look around. You'll see that there's people by these rides. They call them sponsors. They've been around a little while. You know, and they're, come on, take the ride. You know, you don't have to take the ride. It's a suggestion. You don't have to take the ride. But if you take the ride, these sponsors will tell you when to throw your hands in the air and yell and whoop and holler and have a great time. And they'll also tell you when to duck and cover, because both of those will be necessary. And if you do that, and if you take those rides, what you'll find is you'll be incredibly comfortable in the park. You'll not only be incredibly comfortable in the park, but you'll be hanging out by the rides and you'll be looking at somebody going, come on, take the ride. And if you're new, I really hope you take the ride. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Steve. That was awesome. I really appreciate your experience, strength, and hope that you shared with us tonight. I just want a couple takeaways that I got from your talk. You know, I love how you became your dad, and I hear that a lot in the rooms, like, oh, I hated my dad, this, that, the other, and then we end up becoming it, or whoever that person may be, your mom, dad, or whoever it is, and we become that, and then you couldn't see it. It was like that illuminescent that you said, like that awakening, like, wow. It's like you can't see it, and you're not going to make amends to him, and then you finally do, and it's just a beautiful way to have it with the acceptance and the forgiveness. I like your sponsor was saying God's the answer. I think that is so important to hear. Like that's something like why? And it's like that's the answer, and it's always been the answer, but we can't see it. Like with the conscious separation that you're talking about with a new pair of glasses. I like that reference. I love it that you're a special force guy. And, you know, you get through all that stuff and you're in an AA retreat and end up getting shot in an AA retreat. And you calm the guy down that shot you. That's just insane. That's a beautiful, beautiful just example of how this program works. Normally, you'd be running around and want to kill the guy and do this other stuff. And, you know, you're giving a thing about acceptance and forgiveness. I mean, is that God not working or what? That's just beautiful. And of course, the God's amusement park. I mean, that's just a great analogy about the price we pay to get here. And I've known a lot of people who have left the park that never made it back into the park that are no longer here today. And it's true. Enjoy the ride. You know, we're here for a ride. We got in here. We got a seat for you. Put your hands in the air and start screaming and yelling and enjoy the ride and go help somebody else. Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate that. I really appreciate you coming out and sharing with us tonight. So our next meeting is scheduled at 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. We have let's open up the Q&A portion of the meeting from comments in the chat section. We'll read the order they come, or you can raise your hand located in the participant section to share. So let's see, who do we have? We have Gasper. Why don't you unmute yourself? And
I'm unmuted. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic named Gasper. Wow, Steve. You know, that the military groomed you to enter your field. And besides whatever else you had to do, naturally. However, I'm sure you had no idea what God was doing with these words, that he was, and you're a man of words, and that's what you're trying to do, you know. And this is for carrying the message inside these rooms to simplify it and say, come on, you know, follow us. We got what you want. I mean, this is a great journey. That was your message tonight. I heard it loud and clear, it was wonderful. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Hi, Steve. I can't raise my little blue hand. Thank you so much for your share. I just loved your analogies, and I was laughing almost the whole time. Even I see some people weren't laughing because they just weren't getting it in what's inside our heads. Because you were talking about the park and stuff, and all I kept thinking about was holding on to the reins on the merry-go-round, because they got to do that every so often also, because we're up and down in those valleys and those low spots that do come at times. And I love how you were talking about Chuck Chamberlain too, because I was looking for his book when I was bending over, because the ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of our lives, we had to cast them aside in a completely new set of conceptions. And I just couldn't get that at first, but I do now, and I do go to God all the time now. Because in the very beginning, you were talking about those DUIs. You had one mishap. I had quite a few. And we get here, and we don't believe what they say, because I did not believe anything they had to say. And everything they had to say was just saying like what you were saying. Come on, we have what you got. I mean, nobody lies to anybody, even though I thought they were at first. But all everybody wants to do is see you get happy, joyous, and free. And I really enjoyed your share. Thanks, Tom, for getting him to speak for us.
Thanks, Steve, for sure. Steve, you have some notes in the chat if you want to take a look at that also. Anybody else you have like to share tonight, just please raise your hand and we'll call on you.
You got Pat Mack, Tom.
Pat Mack, unmute yourself.
Hey, Steve, how are you, man? I'm Pat Mack, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, bro, when you were talking about your dad and everything like that, you know, I had the same thing with my dad. My dad was we kind of broke apart very early. when I was younger, probably around 16, 17. And we kind of got back together, I want to say, when I was about 49-ish. I'm 57. Well, I turned 57 today. But he passed away also. But the last couple of years, we ended up getting together and settling our differences. And he became sober. I didn't even know it for a few years prior to that. His drink was horrible, and that's what made us split. And I mean, who knew I was walking his footsteps? I always said I was going to be like him, but I was doing the same thing. But I just wanted to say, just getting back together with him for those last couple of years, and getting back into his life, even though it wasn't like you know roses and everything like that, but it was still nice enough to do that. And I was there on the side of his bed when he passed away, holding his hand, and it really meant a lot to me, and it really meant a lot to him, because the last couple of days, he really spoke from his heart to me, and I did the same thing with him, and I know you did the same with your dad, and that's very tough. Number two, you are very lucky that your neighbor upstairs shot you, and you walked away from that. I have one other question: is what step are you on when your sponsee shot you? So this way I know to watch out when I get a sponsee, to be careful on the step that he was on so he don't shoot me. Sorry. Thank you, buddy.
I got to tell you, it's one of these things where, you know, I've had people say you're lucky. I real quick story. When I was talking at a conference shortly after this, you know, people would come up to me and they'd hear the story, and there's an elderly lady, and she's kind of waiting. She goes up, she holds my hand. She looks at me very earnestly, and she says, you know, I know why God saved you. All right. What is it? She says, well, because you have more work to do with us. And I thought, well, that's really a nice gesture. It's sweet. I don't know if my sponsor or my sponsees would agree with that, but that's sweet, right? And then a while later, there's an older guy. He's got an army cap on, and he's got a cane, and he's walking. He comes up to me, he grabs my hand, he does the same thing, and he says, "I know why God spared you." And I'm thinking, oh, it's going to be sweet, right? And he leans in, he says, "Yeah, only the good die young, and I ought to know." And he walks away laughing. Now, he was probably more accurate than she was. You know, there you go.
It's a good song, too. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Do we have anybody else here that would like to say anything?
I'd like to share. I can't raise my hand, though. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hey, Josh. Is that all right if I share?
Yes, go ahead, Josh.
Hi, I'm Josh. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Steve. Steve is my sponsor. He's been my sponsor for about a month now. And I don't plan on shooting him.
Yet.
You know, I mean, there's still time left for me to think about it. But, you know, I was thinking when he shared a minute ago about the people who said, you know, I know why God saved you. And here's where my ego went. Well, it's to help me, obviously. That's why God saved him, is because, you know, to help me, because he knew I needed help, and I do need help, and I'm really grateful that I'm getting to know you, and that was a great pitch all around. Boy, I could, you know, I'm the kind of guy, I could measure a pitch by a guy, by whether my selfish, self-centered, wandering mind can just stay with the guy, you know, and I was with you the whole time. And that's the highest compliment I can give a speaker, because, you know, I'm a kind of, you know, and there's like a computer here, and there's things that I could be doing. And I was with you the whole time. I think the thing that I just wanted to mention that I thought was so beautiful, it's the things that happen to us in Alcoholics Anonymous that are so simple. The wordless exchange that you had with your father at the airport, you know, you just walked up to him. You know, after all what you said about him, the resentment and the I'm not making amends to this guy, and what sounds like years of sponsoring other guys and, you know, not doing it. And then, you know, this opportunity and your sponsor saying, oh, great. You know, you go up to him and go up to Alaska and you see him And, you know, I could just, I have an image in my mind of what that looks like. And it makes me emotional thinking about that. And there's like, there's no words to that. It's just like, you just knew what to do. And, that's like, that's love. That's forgiveness. That's just the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, for, especially for, I don't know about you, but for people like me who are just so closed up and so, you know, defensive, and I'm just not a warm, loving kind of guy. And I got to experience some of that with my mom, who I hated so much. And boy, did I have a case for hatred against my mom. She's an untreated alcoholic who did not like me at all. And I got to have a very similar experience with my mom. And we had a lot of moments like that where there was nothing said. There was just me giving her a hug and her burying her head in my hands. I remember when she was diagnosed with dementia, and she was just, she was formally diagnosed. I'm the reason that she finally got formally diagnosed. She avoided it and avoided it and avoided it. And I figured out a way to get her to the doctor to get this MRI, where the doctor came in the room and told her, you have dementia. And she was devastated. And she, I was the one who got to hold her, and she put her head in my, and I just held her, and I walked her through the last 10 years of her life. And that's a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you, Steve. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you for sharing.
For those of you who are curious, that right there is the bullet. That's the X-ray.
Oh, wow. I've seen that. That is new.
Yeah.
Nice little background you got there.
Yeah.
Is it still?
And Josh, I sponsor Josh, but that was not a paid endorsement.
Is it still in this? Or did they remove it? Bullet.
No, they're just going to leave it there. They'd have to crack my chest open. They can't go up underneath. It came in and went, it's like behind my sternum. It's weird. Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah.
If anybody else like to share tonight?
Ted is raising his hand, I think.
Ted? Yeah, okay, Ted. There you go. Ted, please unmute yourself. I'm looking all over the place here.
My name's Ted. I'm an alcoholic. You know, sometimes you hear that you know, that a sponsor can't make someone drink and that you can't keep them sober. So that's probably the reason that you didn't die. You didn't want to give them a reason to start drinking again. It was a great talk. I really appreciated it. And I can relate quite a bit to your relationship with your dad in totally different ways, but the same kind of feelings. So I got a lot out of the talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ted. As I stated, there's some messages in the chat for you. Steve, if you could take a look at that. Anybody else like to share tonight before we close out? Okay, then, I guess. But you, Amanda, is that a yes?
Sure, I could share. I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Steve, I really enjoyed your share tonight. I was just reflecting today on how grateful I am for AA. It's just like over this past weekend, I just had like volleyball games for the first time since I've been in sobriety, and I'm so grateful because I have my teammates like coming up to me and telling me like, I am so much different. I am so much happier. I seem a lot more stable because I used to be very, the word my teammate used to set, used exactly was, what was it? Not, I don't know what word it was, but crazy, essentially. And it's just really, I'm so grateful to be able to do these things in sobriety. And today, right before the game, my sponsee was calling me, and I got to step out of the locker room, talk to my sponsee before the game, and it's just amazing to be able to be in AA and, like, find so much joy from helping others and the gifts of sobriety that I get, being able to go to school and be an athlete and I don't have to drink over it, because usually I'd get home from a game and I would be heading straight to the liquor store. No matter whether we'd win or lose, I was heading straight to the liquor store for just to, not even a party, just to drink by myself, because I needed that to fill that hole in me. And I'm just so grateful for AA today that it's completely changed me from the inside. That's all I got.
Thank you, Amanda. I really appreciate it. All right. It looks like that's about all we have right now for our sharing. So thank you all for joining us. We have a nice way of closing after a moment's silence for the still sick and suffering alcoholic that does not know if these Zoom rooms exist or how to find us. Moment of silence. And I would like to welcome everyone to unmute yourself so you can join us in the Wii version of the Serenity Prayer or silent meditation of your choice. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.